Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Former State Representative Chris Caruso is here this morning. And Chris, always a pleasure to talk to you. How are you?
Thank you. Good morning, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fine. Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate that. So there's a couple of things I wanted to tackle with you this morning. So you were a state rep during the first go-around of the Ganim administration. And first and foremost, would love to get your input, because I think a lot of people have some ideas in mind that maybe the mayor knew a little bit more than he's leading on to last week when we heard about the former chief and the federal fraud charges. So what was sort of your take on this entire situation? Let's start there.
Well, let me just say it's a sad day for Bridgeport because these acts of corruption continuously occur in this city. And I think if you're a resident like myself, a lifelong resident of Bridgeport, it's very disturbing because, you know, corruption actually retards the quality of life, the economic development, the vitality of a city. And I think that's what we see in Bridgeport on an ongoing basis. And in particular, this mayor, you know, his first administration, you know, a major corruption scandal that placed the city in a very, how should I put it, I guess, paralysis. The image of the city, the reputation of the city, the ability to conduct business as a city was all affected. The taxpayer was affected. The economic development, the growth of the city were all affected by this mayor in his first administration. And now in 2015, he's reelected. Frankly, by the goodness of the people of this city. You know, most communities would not reelect an individual that stole from them, that undermined the democracy in their community, undermined the goodness of their community. But they reelected him. They gave him a second chance. They said, okay, we're gonna give you an opportunity to lead again, and look where we are. You know, two major departments in his city, the personnel director, the chief of police, both are found in corrupt acts that undermine, if you will, the very structure of the government of this city. And it's the same mayor now that is saying he's innocent. He did nothing. He wasn't involved. He didn't instruct others. You know, back in 2003, I remember very clearly, it was the same mayor who said he was innocent right up until the point of conviction. And then even when he was convicted, he continued to plead his innocence, that he had nothing to do with it. And so it's disturbing that, you know, of course, you know, you can't assign guilt on this mayor right now. You know, as this investigation goes on, it may end up where this mayor was directly involved. But just as it was in 2003, we're seeing the same thing happen again. And you know, as I said, as a longtime citizen of this city, as an elected official of this city, it's troubling to me. It's very disturbing to me. The lawlessness, the corruption just undermines anything good. And then you hear the mayor and you hear other people say, well, let's move on. Let's talk about positive things. Well, in all honesty, you can't move on. You can't talk about positive things when there's this cloud stirring around this city. You just can't, because then what you're saying is that you're not paying attention to something that is detrimental to this city and its well-being.
Yeah, Chris, my question is kind of going back to something that you mentioned, though. And I remember that there was this backlash when Mayor Ganim was reelected, because I remember people honestly being shocked about it. What does that say about Bridgeport, though? I mean, it may be other places, you know, maybe other places in the country. I certainly don't check up on politics in every state, every city. But, you know, what does that say, you know, about it? Was it really just like a second chance, or is this something that Bridgeport kind of expects, that, like, listen, like, Mayor Ganim made more sense than keeping, you know, Mayor Finch in? I don't know. I guess it was very, I've never really heard of convicted felons, I'm going to put it bluntly, being back in office, running a city. So when Mayor Ganim was reelected, while I liked the man personally, I was shocked from a reporter standpoint. And Bridgeport stood by it. So, like, what does that say about Bridgeport?
Well, you know, your shock and surprise is acceptable, because most people would be shocked and surprised, wouldn't they, right? You know, here's a guy who robs you in office, who robs the taxpayers, and then the taxpayers put him in again. And, you know, I think there were a lot of things going on. There was those in the political community that weren't happy with Bill Finch and his administration.
Sure.
They had personal gripes and issues.
Mm-hmm.
So they were working against Bill because of that. There were people who just said, hey, everyone deserves a second chance, and Joe Ganim is no different.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the perfect storm, if you will. So you had the infighting going on under the Finch administration by the political figures that just felt he shouldn't come in again. And then you had those in the community who said, well, you know, Joe deserves a second chance. And putting those both together is what made him win. And you know, it's frustrating. I'll be honest with you. I didn't vote for him a second time. I didn't vote for him the first time. You know, I worked with Joe Ganim. I was his very first campaign manager in 1989. And I saw a side of Joe Ganim that would never put me in a position where I'd vote for him. I'll be very frank with you. So I didn't vote for him, and I was surprised that the city, you know, put him back in office. And if you remember during that campaign, Bill Finch was very honest about the history of Joe Ganim, about the corruption, about the arrest. You know, the state Supreme Court would not allow him to get his law license again. You know, there was a clear statement that was made. And if you noticed in the Democratic primary for governor, the entire state, every community voted against him, you know, in that primary. The only city to vote for him was Bridgeport, but not by a very large margin. So that really tells you something. I also believe there are people in Bridgeport who are decent and good to the core.
Absolutely.
I think they felt that, you know, everyone deserves that second chance, mm-hmm. you know, to forgive. And, you know, there's a point of forgiveness. And then there's a point of putting a person back in again, you know.
And I'm hoping it's not that, because, look, I have Christian-based, you know, faith. I too, believe in second chances for honestly, for everybody. I truly do believe that. And I believe in giving people a clean slate. I do believe in that. And I'm just hoping that Mayor Ganim really didn't have anything to do with it. I want to take him for his word that he really did not know that the former chief was doing this, that was rigging the system. I want to believe that. And I think everybody in Bridgeport wants to believe that too, Chris Caruso. But I don't know if that's the case.
And everyone deserves that, you know, innocence until proven guilty.
Sure, frankly. Yeah.
Okay, so we have to extend that. But the mayor is the chief executive officer of the city. These two department heads are directly appointed by the mayor. They're political appointees. They're not part of the bargaining contract, if you will, of the unions. So he appoints them directly. He can remove them directly. And in the chain of command, somewhere along the way, they report to the mayor. And so that's what leaves question in people's minds.
Sure.
The fact that A.J. Perez is a very good friend of the mayor. A.J. has said repeatedly that he loves the mayor. They're brothers. Okay, so there's a bond there. A.J. Perez was the one, he was a lieutenant at the time of Ganim's first administration. He drove for Joe Ganim and frankly was part of the corrupt acts. If you remember reading, A.J. Perez carried the bottles of wine. He carried the suits. He carried the custom-made shirts for Joe Ganim. So when Joe would go to these different you know, meetings where bribery took place, A.J. Perez carried those bribed items with him. So now when Joe Ganim wins in 2015, A.J. Perez is part of his campaign. He was out campaigning for the man. And then when he wins, Joe Ganim has to take the current police chief, who was Gaudette, and has to buy him out of that position, and then has to bring in a $400,000 consultant, Ramsey from Philadelphia, to talk about how the department should run. What are the challenges? You know, what are the opportunities of that department? So the friendship between Joe Ganim and AJ Perez is very strong. It's publicly known.
Right. Everybody knows about it. Sure. Sure. No, right. And I know that's something we had addressed with Mayor Ganim earlier this week, too. Well, unfortunately.
And you know, Melissa, one final thing.
Yeah.
You talk about Christianity. Well, scripture is very clear. When a person sins, there's a point that the person has to make good on the sin. They have to repent. And there's a process to that. You just don't go from the sin to forgiveness, because then the sinner believes that they did no wrong, and that they're just cuddled and accepted. So scripture is very careful, very clear on that.
Yes.
And I remember during Joe Ganim 1, many of the clergy came out and supported him. And I said to clergy at the time, you know, what about scripture? You know, so again, you know, there's a point of forgiveness, and then there's just a point of accepting. And if we accept too quickly without the person really showing that they've changed, you know, then what do we get in the, then we have a repeat performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Chris Caruso, I appreciate your intake this morning and being able to share this with our audience. Thank you so much. And I know I already talked to Paul. He's on next week for me in the morning. I know next week we're looking ahead to September 25th. That's when the Christopher Columbus statue is expected to go back up in Bridgeport. So Paul, I know, is planning to have you on the show next week for our listeners to talk about that. So thank you so much this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Right now, I think we have the governor back with us. Governor Lamont, do we have you here?
Good morning, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
Okay. Well, I know that you are. Yeah. I was telling our listeners before that listening to your press conference yesterday, stressed seemed like it was kind of in the air a little bit, especially when you look at the uptick we've seen in cases. Now, we're certainly nowhere near the high infected rated states at all, but it's certainly of concern. And I know that we're trying to pinpoint where the uptick's coming from. Is it safe to say it's probably schools, only because we didn't see an uptick with 4th of July. We didn't see it with Memorial Day. It's hard to believe if it would be from Labor Day weekend. So is it probably because kids are back in school?
Well, first of all, you're right. We've averaged a little under 1% up until the last few weeks. Now we're averaging, 1.2, 1.3. Yesterday it was 1.6. Remember, the average in the country is closer to 10. Mm-hmm. Those high infection states are at 20. So keep things in perspective. But you're right. You watch this carefully. No, I don't think it's related to schools. I mean, one of the biggest upticks we've had has been at Danbury, and they have not yet opened their schools. I do worry, you know, universities coming back. A couple of bars have been open, a couple of flare-ups there we've had to tamp down. I see a slight uptick going on in Rhode Island right next door, so sometimes it's more of a regional thing, not just an individual state. So we are watching this closely, and, you know, I have a lot of protesters running around saying we're doing so well, just open up everything tomorrow. And I point out, A, almost everything is open, but more importantly, stay cautious. Mm-hmm. We're going to get through this over the next few months, I hope.
So, you know, this morning, I'm sure you've heard Trumbull's Hillcrest Middle School, which is right here in our area. They've decided to go virtual the next two weeks because they had one positive case, and then they quarantined 70 people, and they couldn't get enough teachers to basically fill the absences, which is a problem. And I'm just wondering if we're going to see, especially a teacher shortage. I'm not sure if that's going to be an issue as the months roll on, but is that something that you guys are prepared for, that we're probably going to have to go back virtual, especially if we can't fill teacher absences?
I sure hope not. We've got almost 40% of our K through 5 going to school full time. And if you you see those kids, you see their parents, you see the teachers, how joyful they are to finally be back in a classroom and doing it safely. And at that age group in particular, you know, that fourth grade class, if there happens to be an infection, you don't have to shut down a whole school. You'd shut down or quarantine just that particular class. But perhaps in your case, we found that kid had interactions with others. I got to see why, with track and trace, they decided to close everything. Unless you said it's teachers. And boy, I'm glad our nurses didn't sit out until they felt safe, because we really needed them during the pinch.
Mm. And I heard earlier this week, Governor, you specifically called out New Haven. You called out New Haven Public Schools, and that you would like them to all at least allow kids to go back. They did decide to send back special needs students next week, about 125 students, which I know is hardly the majority. But why? Why the big if we gave the option for school districts to go virtual if they felt it and they think the first 10 weeks they would like to just see how the rest of the state goes, why call them out?
Well, I encourage them is what I would say. I encourage them because they do have one of the lowest infection rates in the country, one of the lowest infection rates in the state. And I just you can wait 10 weeks. But as you know, in 10 weeks, we're going to have a flu season. So I just thought when you have an opportunity to get some in-person education, it's worth trying to do it, but only if you can do it safely. So you're right. I leave this up to local school boards and local superintendents, but I did encourage them, if you find a way you can do it safely, like about 40% of all the other kids around the state are doing, I really encourage you to find a way to do it.
We're talking to Governor Ned Lamont this morning on WICC 600. And Governor Lamont, I know next week you guys are hoping for the special session. Wasn't it today that we were going to find out if the special session's happening tomorrow or next week? Am I off? Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, you were absolutely right. Paul Mounds, our chief of staff, is meeting with the legislative leaders on both sides of the issue. What you got to do is come up with what the agenda is going to
be.
Is there going to be a Christmas tree loaded with lots of ornaments? Probably doesn't work for, a special session. So they're trying to limit the agenda so that we know exactly what we're voting on. Let's face it. Priority number one, I would think, would be to get give some guidance to our regulatory board as regards Eversource and utilities for performance-based regulation.
Sure.
I think there'll be also something as regards voting and make it easier to start processing the ballots earlier.
Okay. What about vaccinations? I know you've been up in the air about what to do about flu vaccinations and possibly mandating.
Deirdre Gifford, our commissioner of public health, she says, look, we're going to do this on a voluntary basis. We're going to make free flu vaccines available to everybody. Take that to a place, pharmacies, fairly qualified, even schools, make it easy for you to get that test. And I think that's the way we're going to do it. We're going to announce that within a week.
Governor Lamont, you had mentioned earlier in your segment that you've been dealing with protesters at times who want to see everything kind of reopen again. And I know when you were in Berlin, we, of course, saw the coverage of somebody who was talking to you about face masks. It sounded like his three-year-old is now going to be required to wear face masks at her daycare. I know that goes into effect, I believe it's next Monday. Beth Bai had said that she is changing things where they're going to up the amount of kids in a group to 16. They are going to have three-year-olds starting to wear face masks. What sort of change there? I know the CDC has always said that if you're 2 years and older, you should wear a mask in public. But with daycares, what sort of change there? Is it because we're upping the amount of kids in a group?
Well, first of all, yeah, there are protesters saying reopen everything now. We've won this battle, and I keep trying to say we're only winning the battle because we're being very strict, and that's why we've kept our rates low. When it comes to the kids, we just wanted to be clear. We've said for K through 12 masks are required. You're right, Beth Bine, the daycare, a lot of the folks who work in daycare, we desperately need them being there. They felt a lot more comfortable if we added clarity. Just say, wear a face mask even for that three-year-old. Look, it's not going to – there's no penalties or anything like that. Just it adds a certain level of clarity to what we're trying to do. And by the way, it's amazing, but I talk to the daycare folks all over the state, and kids do it. Kids are a lot more adaptable than their teenage older brothers and sisters, I find sometimes.
Even the toddlers, really? Because, my son struggles. He's a disaster. Maybe he could last 15 minutes in a grocery store, but if I asked him 3 hours to stay with one on, he won't do it. He's difficult. He's a nice boy, but he will not do it. But they're finding it's not bad, really.
I've been surprised. They're able to – look, if all their friends are doing it, everybody else in the group is doing it. You're right. Beth is trying to up the number of people, kids that can be in a daycare cohort. That means we can expand a lot of capacity as long as the schools are sort of hybrid, 2 days on, 3 days off. Let's face it, daycare is just vital to an awful lot of parents.
Oh, absolutely. No, I completely agree with you. I think the thing that worried me about it, Governor, and if you wanted to weigh in on it, that'd be great. I know it's kind of a question for Beth Bye, but when I was reading through the guidelines with the new mask wearing for daycares, I think the concern is that there are a lot of exceptions to the rule, and I want to say there are some loopholes for parents. So, like, if you have a doctor's note that says that my child has some learning issues, they don't have to wear a mask. If they just joined a program, they've got 2 months to not have to wear a mask. If they just turned three, they've got 2 months to not wear. And I think what I'm getting at is there's a lot of exceptions to the rule. So if you've got half a classroom that's wearing a mask, but then the other half of the toddlers don't, are you hearing feedback that that becomes a problem for teachers now, that you now have to explain, well, Timmy doesn't have to wear a mask because he has asthma, but you do have to wear a mask, Susie, because you have to. Does that become a problem, though?
Well, you've had two sides of the coin. You know, started out saying, isn't requiring it for these kids a little strict?
Mm-hmm.
But you're requiring it with a lot of exemptions. Isn't that a little confusing?
I got to ask the questions.
I think at the end of the day, we're given discretion to the teachers. They know how to handle their daycare better than anybody. We're trying to be clear that we'd like to require this wherever it's possible. It's in the best interest of the kids, best interest of the teachers, and allowing more kids to get back to daycare. So we'll sort it out. It's not punitive, though. I think parents should know that.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's, I think, the big takeaway is that kids are not getting kicked out of programs if their kids are not able to wear masks. That's true, correct?
That's right. I guess the worry is you get a couple of parents coming in and they're sort of defiant and they say, no mask for me. It's handy for a teacher to be able to say, let's see if we can make this work. The governor's said it's a requirement. Let's make this happen.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it. Governor Ned Lamont, thank you so much for coming on this morning, talking about a lot of hot-button topics, and I'm sure I'll be talking to you in a couple weeks.
Great, Melissa. Talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.
Hey, Congressman Himes, thanks for being here this morning. How you doing?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well. Thank you.
So I want to start with, I've actually had listeners personally in the last couple of weeks reach out to me that they're struggling. And obviously, they're not alone. Many Connecticut residents are just struggling to make ends meet at this point. What is the latest on relief efforts and a stimulus package?
Well, Melissa, the good news is that the conversations are still very much live, and I see people moving together, closer together in Washington, right? Pelosi is still at the table negotiating, and you probably saw the president 2 days ago tweeted that he wanted the Republicans to go, as he put it, I guess, for the higher number, encouraging them to get off the very inadequate number that they tried to pass in the Senate. So I'm encouraged by that. I'll tell you, I was in Washington all week, and I feel better at the end of the week than I do at the beginning about our ability to get something done here. There was also a bipartisan group, you might have seen this in the news, called the Problem Solvers Caucus, that landed in a pretty good place. It would be a $1.5 trillion deal, include money for states and municipalities, which is really important because we're talking about teachers and firefighters and policemen here, as well as a recharge of the PPP for small businesses and aid for individuals. So we are not done, and I'm not going to tell you that I'm 100% confident it's going to get done, but we are making some progress.
So any idea, and I appreciate the update, any idea if there were to be a stimulus package, like ballpark, when would people see that money? Like, is there like a deadline when you got to get this in?
Well, this should have been done months ago,
yes.
Right? I mean, the yes. House actually, where I work, we passed a bill 4 months ago called
right.
The Heroes Act, and I won't get into the politics of why that didn't happen, but it has a lot to do with Mitch McConnell in the Senate saying, hey, let's take a pause here. And so here we are in exactly the position you described. I hear it every single day, people hurting that didn't need to be hurting if the government had been willing to act faster. But I guess I'd point you to this, Melissa, the Congress is scheduled to go out of session in 2 weeks. We have a big budget bill we've got to pass on before the 30th of September. So I would tend to think of those as the deadline. So,
okay.
I'm optimistic, but I don't want to give the impression that it's a done deal. There's still some big issues to be dealt with, but I think it's a matter of the next week or two.
Right. And this is probably an incredibly difficult question to answer. So if you can't, that's perfectly fine. But I figured I would take a stab at it. I worry, Congressman, because we are right now in Connecticut. we're slowly seeing those upticks that we had kind of expected. And the governor has said, look, in the next 2 to 3 months, we're expecting to see our numbers jump. I think everybody feels that way, especially with back to school right now. And my worry is, you know, so we get the vaccine. Let's say we get the vaccine in December or January, which is when I think people probably are going to start seeing it. Even then, it's going to our first responders. It's not going to the general public right away. So what I'm getting at is, okay, people are probably going to go well into the spring, if not until the summer, where they're probably going to be struggling. How plausible is it to keep putting stimulus packages together to make ends meet for millions of people? I don't know if that's plausible.
Yeah, well, you know, we ought to be able to reduce the amount of stimulus that we do, right? So the first deal we did, the original CARES Act, which was in the spring, you know, contained a lot of money for work on a vaccine and work on therapy and mm-hmm. more ventilators and lots of PPE, right? You know, we have spent a lot of that money, and as you point out, we're actually relatively close to having a vaccine. Now, you know, there's a whole conversation, as you point out, about, you know, how it gets distributed. Just because you have a vaccine doesn't mean you have the 7 billion doses that, you know, for the 7 billion people on the planet, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got a heck of a distribution challenge, right? Because it's not just the first responders. You know, lots of people will help make this decision. But, you know, it, to my way of thinking, yes, the first responders are at the front of the list. But of course, so are our very highly vulnerable people, older
sure.
people with comorbidities
sure.
that might die, et cetera. So we're going to have quite a societal exercise in figuring out what that line looks like to mm-hmm. get that vaccine. But, you know, the other thing is we've learned a lot, right? You know, we now know and have demonstrated in Connecticut, as well as other places in the country, that if a restaurant reopens and the tables are distanced and, you know, people aren't too close together and you think about the ventilation and people wear masks, you can do that safely. You know, I've been on the train probably 10 times in the last 2 months to go back and forth to D.C. A train is an interior enclosed space, but so long as it's being ventilated and you behave and wear a mask, it can be done safely. So we've also learned a lot. Now, mm-hmm. that's not going to help those restaurants that don't have a lot of inside space as it gets colder. So I'm not saying this is going to be better for everybody, but we are learning a lot about how we can function sort of normally, not really what we would recognize as normally. And, you know, just talk to a teacher about that. but we can act safely here.
Absolutely. Talking to Congressman Jim Himes this morning and kind of switching gears a little bit here, Congressman Himes, but reports say a judge just granted a temporary block for the USPS changes that the Postmaster General was initially calling for. Of course, this is ahead of all the absentee balloting for the election. But my question is actually, so, okay, people have been worried about the absentee ballots, and actually here in Connecticut, I can't tell you how many people reach out to me personally and say, Melissa, can you dig into the fact that I'm getting 4 absentee ballots for my house and there's only 2 of us living here, or I'm getting an absentee ballot for somebody who is not even alive anymore. What is happening with the absentee ballot? I don't know if this is something that's happening across the country, but I know here in Connecticut, I don't know if you've heard about it, but people are getting absentee ballots that they probably shouldn't be, and certainly is not very comforting going into especially a presidential election.
Yeah. So the answer is really simple. And, you know, we got to be real careful about making sure people aren't out there spinning conspiracy theories. Anybody who is registered to vote is going to receive from the Secretary of the State an absentee ballot application, not the actual ballot, but an application. Now, as you might imagine, the role of registered voters is not 100% accurate. People die, people move out of state, kids go off to college. And so what people are getting is they're getting a reflection of what the actual voter registration rolls look like.
Okay.
Now, the polling places are open, so everybody in Connecticut, if they want to, can go vote in person, or you can fill out that absentee ballot application. Now, by the way, if you fill out an application for somebody who died, you are committing a felony. So don't be tempted. And then, of course, you know, once you fill out your absentee ballot application and either mail it back or drop it in one of the drop boxes that are all over Connecticut, usually around town halls, city halls, you will then be sent an absentee ballot. And again, you fill out that ballot, you sign it, you put it in the envelope, If you do that fraudulently, you are committing a felony. You may get to spend some time courtesy of the local penitentiary if you do that. But that's one option that people who are uncomfortable going to a polling place have. But, yeah, folks are going to get applications for people who've moved out of town, people who've died, because, you know, when somebody dies or moves, they don't necessarily call up the registrar of voters and tell them that. So the voter rolls aren't perfect.
Okay. So when people, I just want to clarify. So when people are getting these, when they're saying, hey, I got four absentee ballots, they're just getting applications for them. But there's obviously, like, if you were to send all four in, let's just say to get ahead, you would get caught, obviously, that those people don't exist.
So that's exactly right. So what people are being mailed are applications for absentee ballots. And when you read that application, what it says is, in so many words, I don't want to vote in person. And because of COVID-19, you actually have to check a box. I would like an absentee ballot. Then at the bottom of that page, you sign your name and attest that everything you've done is truthfully. If you do that fraudulently, again, you are committing a felony.
Yes.
So you want to roll the dice on that? You roll the dice on that. But I wouldn't advise it. So, what we're talking about here are applications for absentee ballots. And then you got to send that in, and the local town clerk will then mail you an absentee ballot, which you will also fill out and sign. And if you do that fraudulently, again, I don't mean to keep repeating myself here, but you do that fraudulently, you will be committing a felony. And but obviously that is an alternative way for you to vote rather than turning up at your usual polling place.
No, I appreciate the clarification, because, like I said, in the last couple of weeks, I've gotten personal and just general people, either listeners or people that I know personally, who have called in and have said, why am I getting four or five of these and there's only two of us living here?
That's what the voting rolls show. And people, look, you know, when your kid went off to college, did your kid call up the registrar and say, hey, I now live in Ohio? No, they
most
did
likely
not.
No.
That's why
right.
you're going to get... You know, okay. when somebody dies, the family doesn't typically call town hall. Look, and it's really important that people understand this is an option for you to vote if you don't want to go to the polling place because you're worried about COVID-19. I would highly encourage anybody who does that to do it sooner rather than later, because I'm just so sad the president is creating uncertainty about that. There is zero evidence that there is or will be any form of, you know, systematic fraud around this. Many states have been voting by mail for many, many years without any meaningful incidents of fraud. So it is a safe way to do it. But yeah, what is likely to happen, certainly in some states allow you to postmark your ballot on Election Day. I personally don't think that's a great idea, because what's going to happen? In some states, results may not be known for a couple of days after Election Day. And so, I think the worst that happens here is that there could be some uncertainty in the timing of the results. But again, despite what the president is saying, lots of people have voted by mail for a very long time without any fraud in the system.
Congressman Jim Himes, I appreciate you coming on this morning, and we'll talk in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care now.